clunkier beings in many ways. I mean, every piece of literature has to keep the reader's attention. Someone like Virginia Woolf managed to do it just with language, which is extraordinary. But around the middle of most novels, most writers start to feel the oppressive weight of plotting.
That was Jane DeLurie, author of the acclaimed new novel, Hedge. And I'm John Lee.
And I'm Martin Nutty. And welcome to another episode of Irish Stew, the podcast for the global Irish nation.
This episode of Irish Stew is sponsored by the Irish Heritage Tree Program. Celebrate your Irish roots by planting native trees for family and friends in the beautiful Golden Vale of Ireland. Go to irishheritagetree.com and use the exclusive discount code today. It's IrishStew10 for 10% off. That code again is IrishStew and the numeral 10. Keep the heritage of Ireland green and growing by going to irishheritagetree.com. Hey, welcome back to Irish Stew. John Lee here. And it's August 10th here in New York City, steamy, overcast. And I'm just getting back from a week of vacation in Cape Cod, where I got away from the urban grit and enjoyed some greenery and some nature. And it's really a treat to look at the cover of the book we're going to discuss today and kind of get lost in the greenery of Hedge. Martin?
And I'm going to explain that in a little bit more detail as John glows from his 1 week away in Cape Cod, of which I am quite jealous at the moment. But let's get on to our guest. Our next guest is an author of two well-received novels. She's a native of Sacramento, California, but now makes her home in Baltimore, Maryland. She's a professor at the University of Baltimore, where she is director of the BA in English program. Among other awards, she is the recipient of the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction, an award for her first novel, The Balcony. She now comes to us with her second book, titled Hedge, as John has just told us, which is published by Zibby Books. And with that, welcome to Irish Stew, Jane DeLurie.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's start here, Jane. Imagine you get an unexpected windfall and decide to go on vacation. What's your destination?
Oh, that's such a great question. Can I choose more than one destination?
You can.
Okay. So if I had a windfall and could go somewhere next week, I think I would go to Vanuatu in the South Pacific, where I went many, many years ago in the 80s with my family. And I'd be very interested to see how it's changed in the whatever, how many years that is, 40 years, 35 years. And then on the way back, I think I would go back to Ireland, actually, where I was last summer, because I got COVID, and so we had to completely change this grand tour that we were doing and abridge it. And so it's kind of left hanging there that we want to finish the trip. So that's sort of been, that's the first objective. But if I have a windfall, I would also pull in Vanuatu, because why not?
So tell us a little bit more about Vanuatu. I'm certainly not familiar with it. Is that one of the island territories of France? Because I know you have an affiliation with France, or an affection for France.
It is not. I'm trying to remember the history. I'm going to have to look it up after this podcast. That was the answer that came straight into my head. My father was a real history buff, and he died when I was 16, so I actually can't really ask him this question. I think he kind of started, he was reading about the history of World War II. And so we visited the Solomon Islands because he was reading about the battles of the Solomon Islands. And we went to, we also went to Vanuatu. I think he started to read about the history of that area. And so we ended up going to Fiji before it was Survivor Fiji. It was really hard to get there in the 80s. And Yeah. So there were about three Christmas vacations when we went to the South Pacific, and my dad would just read the history months beforehand. And I'd love to go back.
That sounds like an extraordinary experience. And I noted recently you wrote very affectionately of your father in the LA Times for Father's Day. And you described him as an Irish-American Catholic, I believe, which your last name is Delury. And I kind of poked at that a little bit. And like, how does that square with the Irish, you know, Catholic thing? So I poked at that, and obviously I found out that the name originates from France, apparently in Burgundy. And then I poked a little bit more and looked it up on the 1901 and 1911 census. And indeed, you do find Delury's in both Cork and Galway. Not many of them.
Oh my gosh.
But like,
I love
you,
that you did that.
But like you, I have an unusual last name. Well, your name is pretty a lot less unusual than mine. So yes, indeed, you know, people with odd names can come originate out of Ireland. So,
well, and that name was changed when when my grandfather immigrated. So I wish we could zoom my cousins in from Cork, actually, because this is a big topic of discussion in the family. But in Ireland, we're Dilworths. In Cork, you're right, from Cork. Mm-hmm. My grandfather's from Cork. But there are some Delurys as well. And so I come from this Irish Catholic family with a real history. I mean, I had, you know, distant cousins who were involved in the Irish Republican Brotherhood. So very much a Catholic, Irish Catholic family. But one of my cousins did a history of the family tree, and it turns out that we may have descended from French Huguenots, so Protestants, who had come up, which was a big revelation for the family. So so my father was really interested in the family history, the history of the name, all of that. I grew up hearing a lot about that.
Jane, when Martin, you know, we'll be talking about Hedge in a moment, but when he, you know, he first put the book in front of me, I'm kind of wondering where the Irish is. I know it might come out that Martin has a particular interest in horticulture.
Right.
So I thought that might be the origin, but I wasn't feeling the Irish connection. And then it started to pop up, the references to St. Patrick's Day celebration, listening to the Clancy brothers, having porter cake, straight-laced nun. And there was a line, I don't have quite have it down here, but talking about work, what in the character in the book, work being an escape, and the mother saying she was a lever, referring to the main character. Mm-hmm. And that's a very common thread in Ireland, right? Mm-hmm. The right. Levers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So in Hedge, Maud, my main character, comes from an Irish Catholic San Francisco family that is not. So I grew up in Sacramento. Both my parents are from San Francisco. I'm drawing on elements of the family, but let's just say that my mother is a lot nicer than Maud's mother. So there are a lot of differences in the characters. But she has really, she grew up really wanting to escape that family in many ways. And she ends up moving to England to study landscape history, which in a family like hers is a big act of rebellion. And then she marries an Englishman. So even if it's not consciously that she chooses an Englishman to rebel, there's something going on there in the subconscious. And for me, Hedge is a buildings roman about a woman in her 40s. At the opening of the novel, Maud has just separated from her English husband. She's working on this project in the Hudson Valley. She thinks that she has liberated herself, but as we move through the novel, she's still struggling with this question of family legacy and identity. And at one point in that St. Patrick's Day scene, she recognizes that even though she resists so much about this, you know, culture that she was raised in many ways because of her mother, actually, it's part of who she is. So it's a pretty subtle thread in the book. I'm actually working on something new that is very much about being an Irish Catholic.
Oh,
it's
great.
Much more in the book, but it's there, and it's part of her identity for sure,
and part of yours.
Yeah. And with me, I mean, you mentioned the essay about my father, and I think he died when he was 57, and I just turned 51. And I think I think when you enter your 50s, many people start, you know, you have a different perspective on life. And so I'm entering my 50s, probably partially because of the question of mortality. I just have been thinking a lot about him. And Irish Catholic, being an Irish Catholic was so important growing up, even though, so his father was from Cork. And my father was very connected to that family in Cork. And I'm still very connected to that family in Cork. My mother, actually, both of her parents came. One came from Mayo, from Cross Spalina. And that was the trip that we took with my mother and my daughters last summer. And her father came from Sligo. And my mother was a Sister of Mercy from the age of 18 to 26. It was a very Irish Catholic family. It seems like everybody, I mean, my uncle almost joined the priesthood. Like they all either joined the priesthood or almost did in the third generation. But interestingly, it was more my father for whom this identity was so incredibly important. And Catholicism was so important, even though after he died, years later, in a conversation with my mother and some other friends, I learned that he was an agnostic, which isn't surprising when I think about him as sort of how he was intellectually. But I mean, you know, he would, you know, wring a wet washcloth on my face to wake me up to get to Sunday Mass. I mean, it was just so much a part of my childhood. So anyway, I've been kind of thinking about that and thinking about that Irish Catholic identity more now. And part of that may be, and I'll stop talking, let you ask another question. Part of that may be that France became sort of my second country for a lot of my life. And I don't know how many second countries one person can be on top of.
I thought it was interesting, as we prepare to have this conversation about obviously the deep influence that France has in your life. So as I understand it, your first exposure, well, maybe not your first exposure, but you went to UC Santa Cruz. And then I think your third or so year in college, you fetched up in Grenoble, as I would assume as a part of a study abroad experience. Mm-hmm. Was that your first time in France? And what was the gravitation to the place and how has that played out?
Well, everything goes back to my father here. My father's, on my father's mother's side, that family came from Alsace when it was part of France. So he also, my father spoke French. He also spoke and wrote in German, and he had close ties to our family in France. So in addition to the Ireland connection, which was much more sort of in our daily life, and I can talk more about that, but we visited family in France, and I started taking French lessons at about 7. So that was there early on as well. And I ended up, as you say, studying abroad in Grenoble. I met someone who became my husband. I moved back and finished my degree, ended up moving back there and living in Grenoble for 5 years. And so now, so I had 2 daughters. I'm since divorced from their dad, but both, so I'm an Irish citizen. My dad got me and my brother citizenship in the 80s. Both of my girls are French citizens. So we can all get into Europe somehow with some kind of passport.
Jane, as we get into the book, you're kind of, you know, in a way telegraphing some of the themes in your life that mirror in the life of the character, the main character, Maud. And you had a, there was an article in an Oprah Winfrey website publication. I'm not sure exactly what that was, but it talked about marriage from another culture, another language. And my wife is from Italy. That's sort of my third country,
right?
U.S., Ireland, and Italy. And, we're still together. But, there's a different dynamic there. And it plays out throughout, I guess, in your life and in this book.
Yeah, absolutely.
She is long-suffering.
Yeah.
just to lay that in.
Congratulations to Loretta. You and her. That's great. And also, congratulations on your long marriage. And also, congratulations on juggling 3 countries, which I apparently need to take one at a time. Now I'm back to writing about Ireland after writing about France.
I say when I'm not pretending to be Irish, I'm pretending to be Italian.
Yeah. Well, I spent many years sort of pretending to be French. And I haven't dumped France for Ireland, actually. Again, I'm just going to talk about my 50s again. I think this decade feels like the decade of integration. So, you know, I speak French with my girls. My daughter studied. I returned to France for the first time in 10 years since my divorce in the fall. And that was a real, you know, coming back. And so I think I may not be able to handle a fourth country, but
right,
I'm
right.
getting better with three.
Right.
So interestingly, your first novel, The Balcony, was actually set in France, as I understand, in a estate in a small village nearby Paris. Talk to us about place, because it seems place is very strong in your writing of your two novels. Obviously, The Balcony is set, in, particularly in France, in an estate, and as I understand it, a multi-generational story. And Hedge also has a very strong sense of place that we are obviously going to explore.
Yeah, so I'm definitely a place-inspired writer. That's just all of my fiction comes to me through being in a place that captivates my imagination and sort of feeling characters emerging from that. From that place. So I started writing shorts. I'm also a short story writer, and I continue to write and publish short stories in literary journals. I started writing stories when I moved to France, and those early stories were about the US, which suddenly seemed interesting to me because I wasn't living there anymore. I grew up in the Sacramento suburbs, very disappointed. And that op-ed in the LA Times talks about this a little, but very disappointed in kind of American suburbia and the sameness of it. And I think my father had that feeling too. And that was part of all of the reading he did and the traveling we did. And so when I moved from France back to the US we moved so that I could attend the writing seminars in Baltimore, where I still live at Johns Hopkins, I started writing about France. I started writing about the other place. So that angle that you can have on a place by the distance from it allows me to discover characters who I don't control, who I can follow. And so The Balcony was actually, that first book was a novel in stories. I took some of those stories that I was writing when I returned to the US and started living in Baltimore. And I composed a novel out of the stories. That book tells the overarching story of this property in France, a servant's cottage and this manor house, which was based on a real place. It was based on my ex-husband's grandfather's and grandmother's home and garden next to this forest that we visited often. And I would go running. If you've, John, you know this because you have a marriage with a second language. Sometimes it gets kind of exhausting to speak a second language, especially during those long meals. So I would sort of take a break and go into the forest. And just these stories started to come at me about these people who lived there. And Hedge happened in a similar way. Even though the story opens in the Hudson Valley, as I said, Maud is originally from Burlingame near San Francisco. And in the middle or second part of the book, she's actually restoring a garden at the Presidio of San Francisco, the garden of Juana Briones, who was a Mexican-American entrepreneur and one of the founders of the city that we hear very little about. And the Presidio is where the first nugget from the novel came to me. And it was similar to The Balcony. I was running at the Presidio. My mom would rent a house and the family would gather on the edge of the Presidio. And I went running in the Presidio, and this story of this woman who has this problem, who's working at this site, started to gel.
Jane, we've been kind of roaming the perimeter of the garden here, and we just leapt to the end of the novel. So let's go back and just, what can we tell the readers about the novel? How can we set the scene without giving away the plot?
Okay, yes. So I've already said Maud grew up in the Bay Area. She moved to England. She met Peter, an Englishman. They have two daughters. Her career as a landscape historian or a garden historian flourishes in England. She actually ends up attending to the gardens of Virginia and Leonard Woolf at Monk's House in Suffolk. She and Peter, though, their marriage has been disintegrating for years when the book opens. And when Hedge opens, they've had to move to the Bay Area for Peter's career. Maude has spent 2 years really frustrated, not being able to find work, and very frustrated with her marriage. And so, as I said earlier, she has announced to Peter, I want to separate. And she's taken this job restoring a garden at Montgomery Place, which is a real place in the Hudson Valley that's on the Bard campus. So Maude goes to this site and starts working on the restoration of this Gilded Age garden. And she's sharing the grounds with Gabriel, who is an archaeologist who's doing an indigenous dig by the Hudson River. And in those early weeks before her daughters come out to join her for the summer, once they finish school, she and Gabriel become closer and closer, and this romance starts to brew. But then Ella, who is 13, and Louise, who is 8, arrive to join Maude. And Ella has a dark secret that she's been harboring for several months, that Maude knows there's something a little off, but she thinks it's teenage angst, teenage moodiness. And so once Ella and Louise arrive, Maude tries to incorporate everything, tries to incorporate them into this friendship with Gabriel, and it just really blows up. And so then we jump 2 years later with Maude back in the Bay Area, restoring this garden of Juana Briones and processing what happened that summer. And also still with this question that I don't want to give away, because that's the big plot point of the book. Right.
Right.
Now, it's kind of interesting, your choice of Montgomery Place. I've actually, over the years, visited almost all of the main kind of public estates along the Hudson River. And some of them are extraordinary. You know, the ones that jump to mind are obviously FDR's home.
Right.
Also, there's a Vanderbilt mansion right next door.
Right. Have you been to Blythewood on the Bard campus?
Blythewood, no. And I haven't spent much time on the Bard campus, but I know Montgomery Place is obviously right next door to that. And I think there is a relationship there. But for me, interestingly, Montgomery Place has a particular resonance, even though I've never visited it, because the man it's named after, Richard Montgomery, actually grew up in a house less than a mile from where I live in Conseely. And he was a Revolutionary War hero who died quite early in the Revolutionary War. And funny enough, he never actually lived in Montgomery Place. It was actually named by his widow after him.
But, Janet, right?
Yeah. So he never got to see the beauty of that. Well, maybe he saw the beauty of the place, but he never actually got to live there. But in your preparation for the knowledge, because of Maude's career, right? Did you know anything about garden historians, and how did you kind of get ready for the writing of that stuff? Because that's pretty technical and pretty specific.
Yeah. So when I wrote Hedge, I had just gone through a divorce with two daughters. So that's sort of the autobiographical nugget of the book. And I was very much in the place of, I need to create this new family. I need to keep, I need to focus on these girls, and these girls need to be happy. And so I think that's sort of the spirit driving the book. I had just bought a new home of my own for the first time. And I had this backyard that was kind of crappy and small. And it became my playground, and I learned to garden that summer. I had dabbled in it before, and I've always loved gardens, and so there's some of that in the balcony as well. But I became a very passionate gardener in that year or two as I was writing the book. So in terms of, what Maude does, just to back up a minute, is she goes to these historic estates. They're usually estates because she trains in England. And so she's looking at the gardens of the wealthy generally. And through a mix of chemistry and archaeology, looking at topography, she figures out, sometimes with the help of archaeologists like Gabriel, what plants grew, what features were in the garden, and then she brings the garden back to life. So that aspect of things I knew nothing about. And I mentioned earlier that the idea for the book first came at the Presidio. After running in the Presidio and finding the adobe footprint of Juana Briones' house, I learned about a dig that was done by a team from Stanford in 2012, where they looked at the soil around the house. They didn't find a literal garden, but they found traces of seeds and different chemical components that suggested what might have grown near the house. And so that made me embark in a lot of learning. And what I did because I'm tactile and I need to see things. And so I spent quite a bit of time talking to the experts at Monticello, which is a cradle of landscape history and restoration in the United States, and also conveniently is a 3-hour drive from Baltimore, so right. I could get there pretty easily. And so that first year when I was writing the book, I was doing most of my learning through the 25 books that I bought and all of the articles I was reading, but also going to Monticello, where the very generous head of archaeology and the head of grounds and gardens took me around and explained this kind of work. And they're doing incredibly fascinating work, in particular Fraser Niemann, the head of archaeology, not so much on top of the mountain looking at Thomas Jefferson's garden, which was restored in the 1970s, but down the mountain looking at the homes of the enslaved population that did all the work on the mountain, and who also had their own thriving gardens that sometimes had to sustain the Jefferson household when, Thomas Jefferson's experiments didn't work. So that was my major year of research. It was a lot of trips to Charlottesville.
Jane, besides like there being just, really compelling characters in this book, and like my reading accelerated as I went through it, I found myself, that sort of page turner feeling, not wanting to put it down. So there was that kind of acceleration or pace that I started to feel. But I really started thinking about the garden, and I was an art historian way back in the day. Yeah. And I remember how much symbolism was wrapped around gardens in religious paintings, the Garden of Eden. The enclosed garden was a symbol for the Virgin Mary. Different plants had significance and where they were placed in a painting. And I started to really kind of go down the rabbit hole of looking at your book and wonder how much of the sort of potential symbolism of a garden started. Did you feel that? Were you seeing it? Were there some things that maybe we missed that you know about in terms of using the symbolic, sacred feel for a garden?
It's interesting that you asked that. And I would love you to tell me everything you found, because I think in writing this book, I had to block that out to a certain degree, because there are so many metaphors. There's so much literature written about gardens. I mean, the fact that Maud brings these gardens back to life, the idea of resurrection, I mean, it's almost too much. And so one of the wonderful things about having the book come out actually has been listening to people talk to me about the symbolism they find. In fact, my colleague, who's a wonderful poet, Stephen Leyva, read the book recently, and he sent me this incredible description about all of the Catholic themes in the book and how this scene late in the book that the two of you will remember with Gabriel, where Maud and Gabriel are in this small room together having this conversation, is that the room is described like a confessional. I mean, that was never anything that I set out to do, but I thought, oh my God, he's totally right. And so it was the same thing with the gardening imagery. I tried, whenever I included any element that was symbolic, I tried to make Maud conscious of it so that it wouldn't feel manipulated by me, if that makes sense. And so much of it is just we all have absorbed all of that imagery. So it's in there anyway. Yeah.
I looked at, maybe you could in a second explain the significance of the hedge. But when talking about the walled garden, there's the hedge is often a wall. On the other side is wild, uncontrolled nature. And the inside is a very controlled, curated version of nature.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that word hedge has... so. The hedge wasn't literal at first. It was an aspect of Maud's character that, again, I referred to the novel as a buildings roman. Maud, in that early part of the book, is doing a lot of hedging. She has, moved across the country, and she's telling her daughters that she's doing it for this job, but that's not true. And especially Ella, who's 13, senses that something is not right in her parents' marriage. And so there are several scenes in the early part of the book where Ella is kind of trying to pin Maude down, and Maude is squirming away from answering the question directly. So, but then of course there is a literal hedge, which just abounds, right, with symbolism that it's been, that's, it's that word. Every time I go to an event for this book, people talk about the word hedge and all of the meanings that they see in hedge. And I love that because that's how, that's where a book is out of your hands and in the world. And I think Borges said that a book I'm going to misquote Borges, but it is a creation of both the writer and the reader. And so that's such a great example of that, that, you know, readers can read it and pull out all of this interpretation that I don't necessarily have. I mean, I have the obvious ones, right? But there's a lot more in there.
So two questions jump out to me about what you just said, but let's start off with just one of them. I have a habit of asking two questions, and that's not really fair. Talking about literary figures, William Faulkner, as I understand it, is an important figure in your life. Another Irish descendant, as I understand it.
I didn't know that.
A lot of people, a lot of people understand him, you know, as certainly highly unusual in his use of expressive language. And I know people talking about your book also talk about the kind of initial lushness of the language in the book before it accelerates, as John describes it, into something maybe a little bit more page-turning is probably the wrong word, but you kind of tend to immerse yourself in the book in a very different way.
Yeah.
But talk to me about Faulkner and his role in your writing and in your life, actually.
Yeah. So Faulkner was an early influence. When I was living in Grenoble, I did a master's program at the university, and I needed, long story short, I couldn't enter the master's program in any degree except English studies because my bachelor's degree wouldn't translate into the system. So I had to make that degree make sense. And the way that I did that was I did a comparative study between Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury and the Cubist, the movement of Cubism. And so my research was in French about the Cubist art movement. And I was basically comparing what Faulkner was doing with language and what the Cubists were doing with art, you know, Braque and Picasso. And so I read The Sound and the Fury probably 10 times. And that book was so, it was just ingrained in me. And Faulkner's language and the rhythms of his sentences and he's a difficult writer. It's not, you know, he doesn't write page turners where you just sit down and flip the pages. And both Faulkner and other authors that I'm really drawn to, like Virginia Woolf, tend to have that style. And it's interesting I gravitate in my reading to quiet, introspective, language-driven works. And with Hedge, and The Balcony is very much like that, although there is quite a bit of plot. I seem to like plot. I can't get away from plot. But it was interesting with Hedge how, even in the writing of it, there was this sudden, it's like the rug gets pulled out from under Maude and under the reader, and in some ways, the style, right? And so there is that shift where things become faster, there's a lot more dialogue. And that was just the way this book came out. You know, each book is different. And in my stories, I tend to be much more immersed in language. Obviously, I'm always thinking about character, but much more kind of immersed in language. And I wonder in some ways how the marketplace influences that. I don't know if that's subconscious, but writers today are just bombarded with the fact that readers won't, you know, they can't sustain their attention for very long. This is something that concerns me actually about reading. Sure. And with my students, especially my undergraduate students, we talk about this a lot. Like, what does it mean to sit and grapple with a story and to have to work and to have to read it more than once? And I have no answers to this, but I do wonder sometimes about how much that influences all of the novels that are coming out right now, except maybe in with very small, very literary presses that are kind of doing God's work, I think, in many ways.
So speaking of the mundane, the mechanic, your Hedge is published by Zibby Books. I'm curious about two things. I don't see a lot of novels that are one word. And talk to us about Zibby Books, because that is a smaller publisher.
Very interesting.
Talk to me behind what's behind that choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, you did the two question.
Yes, okay, I did. I can handle it. I'm in trouble now.
You can answer three.
As long as it's not three.
You can just avoid them and just talk about what you want to talk about.
Titles are always difficult for me. And this one just came to me very early on. And I knew it was the title and I stuck to it. And I really did not want it to be The Hedge, which I think actually in an early version of my contract, it was The Hedge. It's like, no, for one thing, I can't write a book called The Balcony followed by a book called The Hedge. Right. But using the article also takes away that second meaning as a verb that was so important to me. So yeah, you know, whenever you write a book and you put it out in the world, there are all these, you have all the, well, at least I do, you know, all these worries. Did I do this well enough? Did I, could I have done this better? The title is one thing with this novel where I just feel like I nailed the title, you know, at least I did that totally perfectly. It's the perfect title. Okay. Zibby Books. So to make what could be a very long-winded story short, my first novel, The Balcony, was published with Little Brown. It was a wonderful experience. My editor was terrific, Jean Garnett. She's a terrific writer of her own right. This just was not the book for her. So we sent the book to her at the beginning of the pandemic. And everything, you know, as you remember, was nutty then. Everything had slowed down, but it just soon became, not that soon. She gave me a round of notes and it just gardening and garden history. And she was always really interested in the core story, but I was so interested in the history and the gardens. And ultimately, my editor that I ended up having did a lot of cutting, by the way. I mean, I joke that my next book will just be everything I cut out from this book about gardens and gardening history. So that was difficult. It is not a fun thing as a writer to have your book, you know, basically turned down. It wasn't explicitly turned down, but that's basically what happened. Like, we decided we need to part ways. That was it was not fun. But luckily for me, right around the same time before, just as we were, my agent and I were getting ready to put the book in submission, which is also not fun for me. She was contacted by Lee Newman, another wonderful writer, short story writer like me, who was on the long list for National Book Award for her terrific collection actually last year. She contacted my agent, said, I'm looking for novel manuscripts. And I knew Lee from actually Oprah Daily, which you mentioned earlier. She had edited one of my essays for them years before. And Lee read the manuscript and she, you know, 4 days later said, I love this. We had a conversation about how to edit it. And so I leapt because I really trusted Lee and I trusted her with the book. And this new press sounded really interesting. So Zibby Owens is a podcaster. It's incredible. She does so many things. It's now become Zibby Media. She's got a bookstore and she does retreats. But when this all started out, I was one of the first manuscripts acquired, even before the company actually existed. Actually, we waited for the company to exist. She had started this press called Zibby Books, and she wanted to put, and she still is putting, the authors at the center of everything. So there's one book per month. It's all women running the company, all women authors thus far, although, you know, maybe there will be a man too. That's great. We're a very welcoming crew. And it's just been this really incredible experience of so much personal attention and attention to my book, from the design, which I love the design. I mean, you mentioned the cover, the paper, the layout, we have an amazing team of women who organize all the publicity and the marketing and tell us how to do social media and, you know, text us pictures to use when we don't know what to do. So the model is just very author-centered and nurturing. And it's been really terrific. And it's been really fun to be part of this because, again, I was there at the very beginning when this was an idea. And so it just keeps growing and growing. Yeah, it's been really a delight. And I've become very close to the other authors. So unlike typical publishing houses, and again, I had a great experience at Little Brown, but this is rare. We are really friends, the authors. I mean, we see each other at these retreats. We text constantly. You know, we guide each other through our author freakouts. There is a serious bonding among everyone. And that is rare and really, really has been wonderful.
Jane, tell us a little bit about the kind of the afterlife. The book is out, it's been printed, it's been proofed. You've seen the review copy, and then it's out in the world. You talked about the way people brought sort of different meanings and ideas to the book that you hadn't considered. But yeah, what's it been like? Has it been fun? It seems to be getting a great reception, you know, the book signings, the readings. Tell us a little bit about that part of the experience.
Yeah, so it's always nerve-wracking. I mean, I say always, I've only written two books, but I'm saying always for all the writers. I'm friends with a lot of writers, and I think for all of us, it's nerve-wracking. It's very nerve-wracking to put your work out in the world. And I will say that review in the Washington Post was like, okay. Yeah. I was like, yeah, you know, I say Joan Frank is now my patron saint for writing that review. That was great. And then being a people pick was great. I mean, you want something to happen, right? And so people are going to like your book. People are not going to like your book. People are going to love your book for the reasons that other people don't love your book. I've been through this once before with The Balcony, but it's still hard. I mean, I won't lie. Like, that stuff is hard for me. It's hard. And I'm feeling really great right now, actually. I'm feeling really great about all of it. In some ways, because like the really active promotion part of things is winding down. And right. I mean, I think most writers are introverts when it comes to their writing. And so I've been waking up at 6 a.m. and working on a new book and still doing things like this, which are terrific. And I love this, but the really like the white heat of right when it gets published is pretty intense. And there are just so many emotions. So I'm kind of glad to be like on this side of the hill a little bit.
Have you had a chance to think about who you'd cast in the movie version?
Well, I mean, yes, a little bit. Well, only one person, actually. Well, I'll tell you, Lily Taylor, who's an actress that I love and does all kinds of advocacy for the Audubon Society and for birds, and has this, she actually lives not far from Montgomery Place. I think she would be great as Alice, but that's the only, you know, that's the only thought I've had. But okay. You know, all that stuff, plus there's a writer's strike right now. I mean, poor Hollywood Yeah. I mean, that stuff is, you know, kind of like the pipe dream.
Right.
And you never know, you know, what might happen with a book, but I have been realizing recently, like, this is my, I'm so happy when I'm working on something new. And when your book is coming out, it's hard to write other stuff. So ultimately what grounds me is writing. And so it's been really nice to be up, you know, speaking of birds with the birds and working outside on something new.
So you mentioned that you've only written two novels. A lot of people dream about writing one novel.
All right, thank you, Martin. Like, thank you.
But obviously, you know, you were doing a lot of writing before that. Specifically, you kind of alluded to the fact you were writing short stories.
Right.
that's an interesting form, because a lot of people say, talk about the difficulty of writing a collection of short stories for publication. But I'm wondering if that form, given our kind of attention deficit disorder because the digital age we live in, that actually shorter pieces are now more powerful and have more opportunities in the mundane issues of kind of marketing, etc. So I'm kind of interested in your thoughts about the form and whether it is maybe more useful and more powerful right now.
That's interesting. Well, you're right. I did spend years writing stories, publishing stories, and not really, even though I read novels, not really thinking about writing a novel. And I mean, the short story form, I adore the short story form. You can do so much in this small space. You can transport readers to so many places and be transported as a reader. I love reading stories. I love the way that they jump right in. And I love how they can get away with a lot of experimentation and playing with language and all kinds of, you can do all kinds of interesting things in that small space. So I mostly teach short stories. And I tell my students, if you want to write a novel, that's wonderful. You're going to learn so much about writing a novel by writing stories and creating tension and creating arc. Novels are clunkier beings in many ways. Every piece of literature has to keep the reader's attention. Someone like Virginia Woolf managed to do it just with language, which is extraordinary. But we're around the middle of most novels. Most writers start to feel the oppressive weight of plotting, right? Yeah. I think maybe I just put so much plot in that it just became a machine of its own. But your question about attention spans and stories is interesting. I try not to read too much about the publishing industry because I was doing that earlier on and it was too much. Like, I know enough to be aware of what I need to do, but I don't want it to influence what I'm writing next. So I'm actually working. I mean, I've started a novel. This is the first time I've said that. I've been calling it a thing that seems like a novel for like a couple months, but I'm declaring it here.
It's official on Irish Stew.
It's a novel. But I'm also working on a linked story collection. And I've been publishing those stories. They all take place in Baltimore, and they're linked by the Cohn sisters, Etta and Clarabelle Cohn, who were these sisters who lived in Baltimore from a very wealthy family, who amassed one of the greatest collections of art, really, in the world, especially of Impressionist art, that's at the Baltimore Museum of Art. And they were just very interesting figures, friends with Gertrude Stein. They knew Picasso, Matisse. So I've been writing these short stories that are many of them are contemporary. They don't take place in the past, but are kind of around the characters of the Cohn sisters. So is this a good practical decision? Probably not. But I don't care, because I'm having so much fun writing them. So and you know, I seem to be doing both. I seem to be writing stories and working on a novel. But I will always write stories. And I also love the world of literary journals. I think it's so rich, and it's filled with real writers and real editors. I have a story coming out. I'm going to shout out the Georgia Review. That story is coming out soon. It's such a pleasure to work with literary journal editors and to be part of that world. So I'll always have a foot in that world.
Well, Jane, you know, our listeners heard it here first. A thing has just turned into a novel, and from what you kind of alluded to in the coming novel, it sounds like we'll have you back again.
I would love that.
Maybe during the white heat of the publicity campaign. look, before we get to your next episode, let's conclude this one with your Seamus plug.
Okay, so my Seamus plug is local. I would like to plug Strength to Love 2 Farm, which is in Baltimore City. And I've been volunteering there since last spring. And it is a farm smack in the middle of Baltimore that grows these beautiful, incredible vegetables for the community and is just an incredible, wonderful place.
Excellent.
You know, that kind of really appeals to me. As John knows, I have a horticultural background. Oh. And I really do think it is interesting, you know, or great, especially for young people to get their hands dirty, to see the actual food that we eat.
Right.
Actually, you know, grow, because who has seen, you know, a zucchini on the vine, so to speak, or tomatoes or anything? I just said the Irish tomatoes there. I'm going to say tomatoes.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
But, you know, I do think seeing things grow is just a wonderful thing. And a lot of times, you know, we kind of get so disconnected from nature. So I think that's
absolutely
a wonderful.
And actually, I'm going there after the podcast. And I'm bringing the chocolate chip cookies I made last night for this team of teens that has been working on the farm all summer. It is hard work. I mean, you know, I only go there for a couple hours a week and I'm wiped out by the end of it. You know, Baltimore's hot. And so anyway, it's their last week. So I'm going down there with some cookies for them. And just as you say, it's great to have just young people being out in the dirt and seeing how food grows. Absolutely.
Planting seeds for the future.
Right, right.
So with that, we do not want to interfere with you getting your hands dirty again today. On behalf of John, myself, and our listeners, really thank you for coming on here and kind of giving us a deeper insight into the writing experience and your life and understanding kind of what's behind the beautiful book that is Hedge. So listeners, please do yourself a favor. Go out and get Hedge. It's published by Zibby Books, and you'll find it in all good bookstores. And for weirdos like me, I actually read the electronic version, and now I'm kind of feeling bad that I didn't get to enjoy the texture of the page. And
I'll send
cover.
You a copy, Martin. Well, I've got a box in my basement.
Well, thank you for that. But it's been such a pleasure. And we look forward to continuing this conversation again, as John said, when the next thing approaches publication.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. This was so fun. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Martin, at the top of the episode, we talked about Hedge as being acclaimed. And one of the places it got its biggest acclaim was in the Washington Post. And there was a quote from that review that kind of modeled what we were trying to do in our conversation with Jane. The quote was, "Please do not let any reviewer or well-meaning friend give away this novel's stunning conclusion." Hope we accomplish that mission.
Yeah, so I'm going to obviously abide by that. But what I would say about this novel is there's a density of themes that's particularly interesting. And we had the pleasure of chatting with Jane for almost an hour, but there was a bunch of questions that I should really have asked. And one of the most obvious ones that struck me, and one of the thematic things that you see rolling through the book, is the actual frustration felt by the lead character, Maud, in trying to be everything to all people. She wants to be a good mother. She wants to have a career with meaningful work. She wants to have a meaningful relationship. And that is a dilemma that I think will speak to any woman that reads this novel.
I have to agree there, Martin. I was thinking of it in terms of this novel has more than one gear, and the pace accelerates as you go on through the book, and it does become a page turner. Let's close it out with a quote I came across about gardening, and I think it fits the theme of this book. The quote is, "The whole garden is on loan from nature, which may claim it back at any time."
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.